Thank you very much, Francis. I appreciate that introduction, but my name is Morris.
I know it.
Not that it really matters too much. What's important is the fact that we're all here this morning. And I want to thank everybody that's responsible for allowing me to come here and share with you this morning. This room is just tremendous. It's filled to the capacity, and I'm overwhelmed with everyone that's here today. I'm overwhelmed to be here today because I had quite a trip coming in. I had to go over to Birmingham to see my brother, my oldest brother, who's been quite ill. And I got to visit with him a couple of hours and got back, and Maggie and Francis met me at the airport, and we went out and had a real good dinner, and so it was just great. But anyway, I'm real delighted to be here, and delighted to be here on such a beautiful day, and to see the changing of colors of the trees, because we don't get them in Houston, and it's wonderful. But anyway, I am Olga Morris, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody, and it's through God's grace and with your help that I'm sober this morning. And by trying to practice the principles of this program in my daily life, I've been able to stay sober for 27 years, 1 month, and 6 days today. And for my time with you, I'm very grateful. As you know, in Texas, if we don't give our sobriety date, they tell us we don't have one. So we have to get that behind us real quick, like. You know, it's always such a privilege for me to be allowed to stand before you, because there were so many years that I couldn't do anything because I was in the throes of alcoholism. I was a crazy mixed up kid all my life, and my problems didn't start when I took that first drink at the age of 16. My problems started when I was born. You know, I never fitted in. I never belonged. I was one of those people that was just a misfit in life. And the strange part about it, I knew it. I knew it all along that I just didn't fit in. And of course, when I found alcohol, I found that magic elixir that allowed me to do the things that I really wanted to do in life. I am from Birmingham. I lived there till I was about 30 years old. All my family is in Birmingham. My husband's people all live in Birmingham. And I migrated to Texas when I was drinking, so that's how I became a Texan. I never would have thought or dreamed in my lifetime that I'd ever been living in Texas, but that's the way my drinking carried me. But I came from a family of four brothers. I was the youngest and the only alcoholic in the family. And, you know, my mother never let me forget it. My mother and father didn't drink. I didn't know what alcoholism was. I certainly didn't know what an alcoholic was. I knew what a drunk was because my Aunt Cora was the drunk in the family. Now, Aunt Cora was on my mother's side of the family, my father's side of the family, not my mother's, but you know that. And we always talked about Aunt Cora because she got in ditches and wrecked cars and had a horrible time with her drinking problem. And she was talked about in the family. Now, I never found out that my mother had a drunk sister until after I'd sobered up, and that was many years later. But we never talked about her. It was always Aunt Cora. And many times in my drinking, my mother would say, you know, you drink just like Aunt Cora. And I probably did. So that was the only alcoholic that I ever knew about. But coming from a family that, there was no alcohol in it, it sometimes makes me wonder about the heredity part of it. Yet I know that there was alcoholism in our family, and later on I found out there were drugs in our family. But anyway, I came along very late in life with my mother and father, and I had to take care of them. And I became a caretaker, you know, almost from the time I can remember. I took care of my mother and father, and I took care of everybody, and I still do to this day. But I'm not quite as bad as I used to be. But my mother and father were not well, and so I used to have to do a lot of things. And since I came along, you know, so late in their lives, they were much older than kids that I went to school with, their family. And that made me feel different from the very beginning. But I would go to town and pay the bills, you know, take care of things that grown people did. I can never remember being a child. Can't never remember being, you know, a little girl that played with dolls and played with playmates and things because I was always so busy taking care of somebody. And I went to school and I hated it because I was skinny and tiny and ugly, and I knew it. And, you know, even the little boys used to call me bird legs, and that didn't help any, you know. But I was real smart, and I was smart enough to know, and I hated school, but I was smart enough to know that if I studied real hard, you know, and made real good grades, that I'd get out of school quicker. You know, I often wondered why my daughter never figured that one out, but it didn't take me very long to figure that if I could skip a few grades, you know, then I would get out of school quicker, and that's what I did. And I got out of school when I was 16 years old and out of high school, and I knew exactly what I wanted to do and be at that early age of life. I was a very independent little girl. I never allowed anybody to do anything for me. Like I said, I was always doing for them. So when I was 16, my daddy wanted to send me to college, and I said, no, if I go to college, you know, I'll work my way through. I don't want anybody sending me to college. And I went out and immediately got a job. Now, at 16, jobs weren't, you know, you don't get too many jobs, but I was a secretary, and I went to work for an insurance company. And this insurance company, they had a bunch of girls that worked there, and they were much older than I was. And one day they came around and they were going to have a little party, and they invited me. Now, you got to understand, I'd never been invited to parties. People just did not invite me to parties. I was this misfit, you know, the one that sat over in the corner and never got invited to anything. And when these girls invited me to this party, I was absolutely ecstatic, you know. I was absolutely going to be going to a party. And I thought this was wonderful, you know, so I did go, and they passed around these little drinks, you know. And I decided I would take one because I didn't want to be different. I never wanted to be different. So when they passed around the drinks and I drank this drink, I'm not going to stand here and tell you that I think at that moment I became an alcoholic. I'm sure I probably was all along. But what I'm trying to say is it didn't make me any different. The only thing that it did for me was when that drink went down, I knew that I had found the magic elixir that was going to let me live in this world and be happy. Now, almost immediately, you know, I was able to talk to people without being scared, like I always was. And the room kind of lit up and was warm, and everybody was friendly. And it was the most wonderful feeling. I used to, in my drinking, try to capture that feeling again of that first drink, but I never could. But I felt so good inside. And, you know, for a long time, alcohol did that for me. It allowed me to live in this world and to find a niche in this world that I could feel comfortable in, and treated me kindly. But we all know that alcohol turns on us as it did on me. But for a long time, alcohol was my friend. And, you know, and sometimes in retrospect, I think that alcohol probably saved my life because I was so introverted and not able to talk with people and not able to do the things that I wanted to do. You know, I don't know what might have happened to me if I hadn't been able to have something that allowed me to get on with my life for a little while. But as we know, you know, alcohol does turn on us. And I think I was the kind of alcoholic that for a short period of my life, I was able to drink sort of socially, if you want to call it that. Drink for a period of about 10 to 12 years, you know, before you pass over into chronic alcoholism. And then there's the primary alcoholic, you know, that the minute he takes the first drink, he's off to the races, you know, gets into trouble, personality changes, and the whole nine yards. And that was not the way it was with me. I was able to drink for a few years without really getting into trouble or it affecting me too much. But I was a real workaholic. I was a workaholic long before I became an alcoholic. I'm still a workaholic. But at that particular time in my life, I knew exactly what I wanted to do and be. At the age of 16, I knew that I was going to be the best businesswoman that there ever was, that I was going to be well-educated, and that if I ever married, which I doubted, it would be to a millionaire. So I had my life all planned out for me, you know. But I went on, and at the age of 21, I got the best job I thought that, you know, that I could ever possibly get. My father was a research engineer and a very brilliant man, and his whole life was devoted to his work He didn't have time for his family or his children. Now, I'm not saying he was not a good provider, because he was. He saw that we had everything that we needed. But, you know, when you're raised in a family like that, somehow or another, you know, it does affect you a great deal. And my mother, being the domineering lady that she was, I always said, you know, I'd never be like my mother, but I ended up being just exactly like her. But anyway, I got this job when I was 21, and this man reminded me an awful lot of my father. It was with an engineering firm in Birmingham, and I was so happy to get this job because I had always loved this kind of work. I used to help my daddy. He only had one arm, and he used to call me his right arm because I would help him with his drawings and help him build these little models and things that he was working on. So I was in my field there. I felt like this is what I wanted to do. And the man that I was working for, as I said, reminded me of my father, so I felt real at ease with the job. And I became very, very good at my work. This man took me under his wings and taught me everything I would ever know about engineering. I did not have a degree in engineering, though I'd been going to school at night for many years. I had no degree, but he taught me a lot about this particular business that we were in. And part of our job was estimating equipment and machinery that went into the large coal preparation plants that were built by DuPont after the war. And I was real good. I was a con artist, you know, from day one. And I would sit in the engineering meetings, and you'd think that I was a full-fledged engineer because I knew the talk and I knew how to act, and I was good at it. So I became very good at my job. Now, at the age of 21, I also had another event that happened in my life. I met a young man. Now, my brother was my idol. He was in the Marine Corps. And my brother was 6 feet tall and had black curly hair, and I just worshiped my brother. And I always thought, you know, if I ever marry anybody, he's going to look just like my brother. And my brother was a real dresser, you know. Boy, when he put on his clothes, they were just perfect, you know. And this was the kind of man that, you know, if I ever married, which I doubted, if I ever married, it was going to be just like my brother. So my brother came home from the Marine Corps about this time, and he brought home this young man with him. Now, the young man was short and blonde. And when he wore his suits, they didn't, somehow the ties and all the stuff didn't match, you know. And the socks wouldn't match, you know. Nothing would match that he had on. And so he brought this guy home, and my brother was dating my best girlfriend. And because I didn't want to be left out, and I wanted to go out and party because that's where the drinking was, you know. I wasn't about to say, well, I'm not going to go out with this guy, you know. But I remember going back in the house and changing and putting on low heel shoes because I thought I was taller than he was. So we went out to dance, and 6 months later, I married this young man. Now, I didn't want to marry him. I mean, that was not in my plan. You got to understand that. But he asked me to marry him every single time we dated, which was practically every night. And finally, I just said yes. You know, I got tired of saying no. Now, I know today that God picked that young man out for me, and because he stayed with me and saved my life many times in my drinking. And I know that that it was God's choice, not mine. You know, if you've never given anybody any love, or you've never felt that you ever got any love, how are you going to love anybody? I was so selfish and self-centered in my own life with going out and trying to get material things for my life. How could I possibly ever, you know, give love to another human being? I wasn't capable of that, but I know that God picked him out for me. But anyway, Jim came into my life, and we began to have a very strange married life. He was working out of town, and I was working day and night. I'd go to work like 8 o'clock in the morning. I'd work till 5 in the afternoon. And then my boss would bring out a fifth of old granddad and sit in the middle of the desk. Now, I didn't know that this man that I admired so much and I was working for was an alcoholic. Because, see, I'd never heard about an alcoholic. Only thing I'd ever heard about was a drunk, Aunt Cora, you know. So how could this man, you know, be an alcoholic? He drove a Lincoln Continental, he owned a business, and, you know, they're just not drunks, those kind of people. But anyway, he brought out the fifth of old granddad and set it in the middle of the desk every afternoon, and we'd just go around and have a little drink before we went home in the evening. Now, that's what normal people would do, right? Go and have a little drink and maybe go home and have dinner with their family. And what we would do, we would have a little drink and another little drink and another one, and after everybody else had left, we'd finish his fifth, see, and then we'd go home and come back to work at 8 o'clock that night. And we'd work from 8 till 5, 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, and then be back down there again the next morning. So that was the way I was living. And I was very young at the time, and I knew what I wanted out of life. I knew I wanted this material stuff that you had to get, you know, to be happy. Because that's what was going to make me happy. When I got the beautiful homes and the beautiful cars and the fancy clothes, if I had all of those things, that's what would make me happy. And I knew this. And I was willing to work for it. I didn't want anybody to give it to me. I was going to work for it. And I was doing a good job at it. I was working very hard, and I was making a lot of money. And Jim was working hard and making a lot of money. And together we were beginning to get all of this stuff that was going to make us happy, that never seemed to make us happy, but was going to make us happy, you know. And even though my husband was not an alcoholic, if you live with a practicing alcoholic, as most of you Al-Anons know, you become quite ill too. And he was getting there. But anyway, my drinking was getting progressively worse. I was in my 20s. When I was 25 years old, I needed Alcoholics Anonymous as much as I needed it when I was 40, when I sobered up. And I didn't know anything about AA. You know, in those days, you didn't pick up the newspaper and read about it. You didn't have the TV that flashed on, you know, about all the treatment centers and everything. Or you didn't have the schools teaching about it. In fact, you didn't even mention it, because if you were an alcoholic, you were someone pretty bad. And the words just never appeared anywhere. I can't ever remember hearing about Alcoholics Anonymous, because, you know, I couldn't possibly be an alcoholic. Here I was. I was making probably more money than just about most any woman that I knew of in business in Birmingham. So, you know, I just didn't fit in that category. But my drinking was beginning to really get pretty bad. When I was 30 years old, this man that I admired so much that I worked for had what we might call a wet brain. He just really, you know, had to give up his business. He was very ill, and I didn't know what was going on. And even though my drinking was so bad, I knew that being a good workaholic, I had to work. And I began to look around for a job, and I was, as I said, I was real good in the engineering field, and I really loved it. But I got a job, and this is an alcoholic for you. Instead of staying in the field that I loved, I got a job for the largest department store in the South, working for the president of the company. And I know today why I took that job. I didn't know it then, but I had access to all the alcohol I could ever drink. I had an expense account that allowed me to entertain. We used to put on these large fashion shows in Birmingham, and we would invite celebrities from Hollywood, dress designers from Paris, shoe designers from Rome, and it's my job to entertain these people when they came to town. So I know why I changed jobs. I know why why I got into that field, you know. And I was good at my job. Even though my drinking was pretty bad by now, I was still very good at my job. And my husband, you know, never really liked what I did. He didn't like my drinking. He didn't like my friends. He always said, "You always try to be such a big shot, you know. Why don't you try to be yourself, you know?" And things like that, you know. And it just kept going all the time. And I was wearing these we're talking about many years ago. I was wearing these $500 designer dresses. Now, today, my God, it must be $2,500 today. I don't know. I don't wear them, so I don't know. But I wore them at that time, and I was really trying to be somebody that I wasn't. But I was doing a good job for this man, and he thought I was just absolutely wonderful. I was very sick at this time. I know that today. I see people, young people coming in the program, and I can see myself in so many of them. And I wish that I could have found the program at that time, but it just wasn't meant for me to do that. I was so sick that I would, and I didn't know what was wrong with me, was the sad part about it. I would shake so badly in the morning that I couldn't get to work hardly. And I knew that if I just took a drink before I went to work, that I'd calm down and my hands wouldn't shake. Now, many times, you know, and I fooled a lot of people about my drinking, and I know you can't fool everybody, and I know that it shows. But back in those days, as I said, people didn't recognize alcoholism as much as they do today. And I would go to work shaking, and people felt sorry for me. They thought I was real sick. Well, I was with alcoholism. But I had gone to the doctor, and the doctor had told me I was a diabetic. Well, hell, you'd be a diabetic, too, if you walked in there having consumed a fifth of vodka, you know, had your blood sugar checked. I think you'd be a little diabetic, too. And the doctor gave me a beautiful card to carry. It said, "I am a diabetic. I have not been drinking." Don't you wish you had one? You know, I've told this story all over this country, and you know how alcoholics are. We tell something so long, we begin to believe it if we're lying, you know. And I got to thinking, Ogden, did that really happen to you? And this, because I'd never heard of anyone else that ever got one of those cards. And I think it was in Iowa or someplace out there, and this guy came up to me after I talked. He said, "Oh, God, I got one of those cards, too." So I knew I hadn't been lying, you know. But he did. He gave me this little card, and I used to carry that thing around. Everybody felt so sorry for me, because when I passed out, you know, it was a diabetic coma instead of But anyway, I used to have to carry my bottle to work with me, you know, and have a drink, you know, in the mid-afternoon, and then go to dinner and eat, you know, drink your lunch. And it got to the point where I had to have alcohol in me all the time. And it was beginning to affect my job. You know, part of my job was sending our buyers to New York twice a year. And in those days, we didn't have the computers, and we did it all by hand. And I was able to write these little blue vouchers. And for any amount of money that they needed for the trip, like $1,000 or $2,000 or whatever they needed, and I could walk over to the cashier's cage and pick up this money and give it to the buyer, and then when they got back, they would check back in with me. Well, I found myself writing these little blue vouchers and taking them over the cashier's cage and getting this money, but this money never got to the buyers, you know. And, you know, I never thought that this was stealing. I really, honest to God, never thought it was. You know, there were no thieves in our family. I came from a very fine family, you know. And it just never occurred to me. I would say things like, "They owed me this money. I've been working real hard. I worked all this overtime, you know." Or, "I'll pay it back payday." And, you know, it never got there. You know, I mean, payday never got there, and I never had the money to pay it back. And I could con my poor mind into whatever I wanted it to believe, you know. I don't know about any of you alcoholics if you ever did that, but I could make wrong right anytime I wanted to. Anytime I wanted to. And that's what I would do. Now, I considered myself highly educated. I thought I was tops, you know. I wasn't, but I thought it. And you'd think that this very brilliant mind would have figured out that we have auditors that come around and check on little things like embezzlement, you know. But it never occurred to me, you see. I heard a speaker one time from North Carolina used to talk about commingling funds. Well, that's what I was doing. I was commingling their funds with my funds, you know. But anyway, we did have auditors, and they did come around, and they did find out I was taking this money, and my boss called me into the office to talk to me. Now, he respected me. I was still doing a tremendous job, and he couldn't understand what was going on, and neither could I. I had no answers for him. All I could do was say, "I don't know," because I didn't really know what was going on in my life. They called my husband down from his job. He was working up on the Tennessee River on the dam sites up there doing some engineering work. And they called him down to make restitution for this money I'd taken. And to this day, there were no charges filed, nothing. Thank God that the statute of limitations has passed. I can tell this all over the country. But anyway, my husband paid back all this money, and I have no idea how much it was. To this day, my husband never, ever mentioned it to me, and I sure never asked. But I know one thing, that it took everything that we had worked so hard for. I mean, it was just wiped out. I mean, everything that we had. Now, right then and there, you would have thought that I would have got down on my knees and thanked God that I didn't have to go to prison. But instead of that, I went home, and I threw my purse on the bed, and I turned to my husband, and I said, "This two-bit town ain't big enough for me. I'm leaving." And I got in my car and drove 250 miles to Mobile, Alabama. And that was the story of my migration from Birmingham. You know, in all seriousness, I started going to prison as an AA volunteer when I was 6 months sober, but for the grace of God, I should have been there. And I have continued my prison work ever since then. And that's been 27 years that I've been going up to the women's prison in Texas. But I wasn't very grateful for anything at that time. I was arrogant, self-centered, and all I wanted was just more, and I set out to get it again. I landed in Mobile. I got myself a job at the largest department store down there in Mobile, and they were so delighted to get me because I had worked for this man who was very well known in Alabama, the president of this store that I worked for, and they didn't even bother to check references. And I told them a song and dance, you know, about I had moved to Mobile, and I was looking for work, and I'd worked for this man. They were delighted to get me, only to fire me a month later because I couldn't go to work without my bottle. Now, you see, I'm suffering not only from alcoholism but from a tremendous amount of guilt, and I have to drink. I have to drink about every couple of hours to keep me going, and I have to take my bottle with me, and they found it a couple of times, and then they let me go. And I just walked across the street and got a job with their competitor, you know, and of course that only lasted a couple of weeks. And by now, you see, I'm beginning to be unemployable, and I have to work. I know I have to work. I have to work to live. I have to work to eat. I have to work to do all these things, you know, because I'm so work-oriented in my life. And Jim came down to be with me in my misery, and I'm telling you about how sick he was. And if he were here today, he'd tell you how sick he was. And he continued to stay with me, thank God. But he was as sick as I was, and neither one of us could get work because he couldn't work because he was too worried about me, and I couldn't work because of my alcoholism. I would get a job, and I could keep a job for about a week. You know, that would be max, and then they'd have to let me go because I'd get drunk. And I didn't have any way of getting any money, so, you know, what was I going to do, you know? And then I began to write the hot checks, and that was my hot check life. Which, you know, I'm not proud of any of these things, but these are the things that it took for me to get where I am right here today. I would get a job and then just get fired, and then I'd get another one, and I could do anything. I was like the great imposter, you know. I could do anything. You just ask me, I can do it. And I darn well did it, you know, maybe for a short period of time. When I sobered up, I got a job out at NASA. I was the first alcoholic that got a secret clearance at NASA. And the reason I got it was I was totally honest on my application, and I put down that I had 19 jobs in 1 year. And the Naval Intelligence were so enthralled by all of this that they came out to interview me. They said, "We've never heard of anybody that had 19 jobs." I said, "Hell, those are the only ones I can remember." But anyway, I did get a secret clearance. But that was the way I was. You know, I worked at so many different... I was an interior decorator. I worked as a surgical assistant for a dental office. I mean, I could do anything. I was, you know, just name it, and I would tell you I could do it. But those days soon ended, too, where I was not even employable. And that's when I started writing these hot checks. I had to have money to drink. You know, alcoholism was devastating for me.
I mean, I couldn't go more than, I mean, I had alcohol in my system at all time. I couldn't go more than 2 hours without taking a drink. That didn't mean I was drunk all the time. It didn't mean I walked around drunk. I was not a stumbling drunk. I never was a stumbling drunk. If you didn't know me, you might not even know I was drunk. I've been in a blackout many times, and people didn't even know that I was in a blackout. And my motor section, you know, just still functioned even when I was totally drunk. But anyway, I would walk into a place and write a hot check, you know, and they would cash it. You know, I've had this white hair since I was born, and you know, who wouldn't cash a check for me? You know, little old lady, you know. My husband, you say, heck, I can't even cash a good check, and you go in there, you can get one cashed anywhere. But I knew that I had to have alcohol to live now. It wasn't fun anymore. It wasn't doing anything for me anymore. The only thing it was doing was allowing me to live, to function, to get up and do whatever I had to do to get another drink. And we lived in this little house way out in Spring Hill, way out in the country, really out there. And half the time, you know, we would be evicted from the house. Half the time, we wouldn't have money to have the lights on or the water on. And I would, you know, steal the water from the neighbor's faucet next door, you know, at night to have water. It was the most god-awful, miserable time of my life that I can ever remember. Many times I needed to drink so bad at night, and we had no money, and maybe Jim might have earned a few bucks that day doing something. And I would steal the money from him during the night and run down maybe a block from the house and call a cab to come out from Mobile and bring me a pint, because I've got to get through the night to live. And I would hand him the last dollar that we had to get that bottle to get me through the night. Many times I was at the liquor store that Francis was talking about, and I would have only enough money to buy a bottle of vodka, because I'm drinking vodka now, because you know you can't smell vodka. And I'd have just enough money, you know, to get that fifth. And I'd have it in my hands so tight, and I'd have my hands behind me like this. And me and all the other alcoholics, the minute that door opened at 9 o'clock, would run in there and throw that money on the desk and ask the guy, you know, for a bottle of vodka. And he'd put it in that old brown sack. And I'd run across the street because I needed a drink so bad I could die, and get behind a big old billboard that they had there and tear the top off of that bottle, you know, just as fast as I could, and get that drink and let it go down. And when it hit bottom, I knew everything was going to be all right again, and I could start my wheeling and dealing again. And that's the way I lived. Can remember the total degradation of the alcoholic woman. You know, I know the men have a hard time when they're drinking, but I think the woman alcoholic has the hardest time of all, because we have so many things that we have to deal with in our drinking, and I think most of you women know that. But I would walk down, fixing to catch a bus, and I'd throw my empty bottle under a bush there, and this lady came out, and she says, "I wish you wouldn't throw your whiskey bottles under that bush. My children are seeing them." And I wanted to die. I wanted to die. This is the proud woman that wore the $500 designer dresses. What degradation that you feel. Many times I had to have a drink before I went to work, and I'd still trying to work, you know, at some little old place. And I'd walk into the hotel down there in Mobile, and I don't even remember which one it was, but I think it was the Admiral Sims. And the bell boy knew me so well, he would go in and get me one of these little miniatures and give it to me so I could get to work that morning. It was just the most god-awful time of my life. As I said, Jim couldn't work either, and we were just existing was all we were doing. But you know, in all of this, and not having any money and not having anything, I always had a car. Now, I'm a car person. I like cars. I like fast cars. I like to drive fast. I love sports cars. I love, you know, anything. Boy, if it's moving, that's me, you know, because I like to move. And I had a car that would have just killed a normal human being if they had been driving it. It was an old 46 DeSoto, and it had no floorboard in it, and all the fumes came up, you know, like this. And if I had been a normal human being, it would have killed me immediately to drive that car, but it didn't bother me any. And I would hitch an old U-Haul it, you know, behind that thing and take off for Birmingham to my mother's home. And she would give me something, you know, thinking I needed it. And what I needed it for was to pawn it. Because I was a great pawner. I would pawn anything I could find. I pawned my diamond rings. I pawned my fur coat. I pawned everything, even Jim's shoes one time. You know, anything that had any value that I could get a buck for, so I could go buy a bottle. That's what I would do. So I would drive this 250 miles up to Birmingham, and my poor old mother would give me something, thinking I needed it, like a piece of furniture or something. And I'd put it in that old U-Haul, and I'd tool on back down the road, you know. And I would get in a ditch. I got in ditches up and down that road that you would not believe in. And one day I was coming on down that highway, you know, and the police stopped me. And they said, Miss, we've been following you the last 10 miles, and you've been in every ditch up and down this road. And I'm going to take you on to jail. And I said, now, wait a minute, officer. You'd be drunk, too, if you drove this car. Just get into the car and drive it down the road is all I'm asking of you. I'll sit here with your buddy. See, I'm still controlling and directing. I'll get in the, and, you know, stay here with your buddy, and we'll follow you, and see if I'm not telling you the truth. So he gets in the car. He drives it on down the road. He stops, and he tells his buddy, anybody that drove this car would be drunk. And I get off again, you know. And if I didn't get off, I'd just write a hot check and give it to him, you know, and go on down the road. And if they put me in jail, you know, I'd stay there. I would never, ever call anybody to come and get me out or bail me out. And many times I would be 2 or 3 days late getting home, and my mother would call Jim frantic, where's Olga, you know, or vice versa. And he'd always say, well, she's in jail someplace, you know. She'll come home when she gets out. And I always did. But things were very, very bad there. This car that I possessed, the finance company wanted it back. And I was writing these hot checks, and the police called me in, and they told me that if I didn't pick up these checks and do something about writing these checks, they were going to put me in prison. And I believed them. I believed them with all my heart, and I told them that I was going to quit drinking and that I was going to get a job and I'd take care of these checks. And I believed that, too, with all my heart, but there was no way I could do it. And I got out of that police station and walked across the street and wrote another hot check and got another bottle. And that was the way I was living. And Jim came home one evening, and he told me that he had picked up a Houston newspaper. If any of you have ever seen the Houston newspaper, it looks like the want ads in there look like we could, you know, give jobs to the world because there's so many of them there. And he said, maybe if I go out to Houston, I can find a job. And I thought that was the best news I had heard in a long time, because I had been trying to get rid of this guy for years. I've had told him many times, if you don't like the way I live, there's the door. I've worked all my life. I've made more money than you've ever made. If you don't like the way I live, leave. But he never would leave. And so this was my golden opportunity. Now, I don't know what I would have done if he had left, because many times he had spoon-fed me to keep me alive, because I wouldn't eat when I was drinking real bad. Many times I was in the hospital. One time they gave me 13 quarts of glucose to keep me alive. And I got out of the hospital before I got home. I'd stopped and bought another bottle to get me home. So I don't know what I would have done had he left, but I wanted him to leave, you know. So he came out to Houston, and he got a job all right. He got a job down on Congress Street, which is our skid row on Congress Street, working in a spaghetti joint and living in the Salvation Army for 50 cents a night. Now, say I've got the only Al-Anon that made Skid Row before the alcoholic. But then, you know, the finance company wanted my car. The police were after me and requested that I leave town. And so I thought I better go. And so he said, well, he would meet me, and so he didn't have any money to send me to come out there. So, of course, you know, I just wrote another hot check to get the money to go. And I'm a cat lover. I don't know how many of you are cat lovers, but I love cats. And at that time, I had 4 cats and 2 dogs. Now, I didn't have a dime to get out to Houston, but I'm going to get these dogs and cats out there. And so I go down and I box them all up, and I'm going to get ready to get on the train, you know. And one of my tomcats is missing. So I con the cab driver to take me back out to Spring Hill to pick up my cat that's missing. And the only thing that I had left that belonged to me in this world was a lamp that my mother had given me. Now, why I still had that lamp, I don't know. But anyway, I told the cab driver if he'd take me out there, I'd give him this lamp. And he agreed to do that so I could find my cat. Now, I had no problem with insanity when I got here. You got to understand that. And so he took me out there, and I found the old cat and put him in a box, and I slept in that empty house that night in the bathtub. The worldly possessions I had at that time was an old white jersey dress. Now, it used to be sort of a cream color, but it had been washed so many times it was white. And it was also one of these dresses that expanded as you expand in the waist. Now, I weighed about I weighed about 187 pounds, and I'm not very big, and I was fat. I'm going to tell you, I was one fat, drunk woman. And this old dress just, you know, it would just expand as you go along and get fatter. You couldn't pay me to wear a jersey today. But that jersey dress was my sole possession. And anyway, I got on the train, and that's a whole new story about the train trip. I'll just say that I did a lot of conning on that train trip, and I ended up in Houston and right down, the train stopped down right in Congress Street, so I had no problem there. And Jim didn't meet me that night, and I somehow ended up in an old hotel down on Congress Street. Now, if you've ever seen movies of Skid Row and the old ironstead, bedstead, and one dresser over here, that was the way this room looked when I woke up that next morning. And on that dresser was a bottle of vodka with just a little tiny bit left in the bottom of it. And I can remember how sick I was that morning, and I said to myself, now, if you can just get up and get out of this bed and crawl over there and get that drink and get it to stay down, everything's going to be all right again, and you can start your wheeling and dealing again. And that's exactly what I did. You know, they say that we have to be on Skid Row before we can find sobriety. Well, they don't mean Skid Row the place. They mean Skid Row in your heart. And it was not there for me yet. And I got myself together and got that drink and got it to stay down, and I started my wheeling and dealing, and I conned this lady, renting us an old house out in Gulf Gate, which is not the best part of town. But it was a house. Now, this is when in retrospect, I can find where God really touched my life. I know He was with me all along. I know that today. I didn't know it then. But so many things happened to me that shouldn't have happened that had to be because of His power. This was one of them. Who would rent you a house without a deposit, without furniture? We had absolutely nothing. And she rented us this little old house. We didn't even have a job. So we slept on the floor at night, and we used to cover with the newspapers. And the people next door had something to do with the farmer's market, and they used to bring the old vegetables in that nobody wanted that we could eat, and the old canned goods that were dented that nobody wanted, and she would bring those for us to eat. And, you know, I've still got a can of onion soup that was part of that. And many years ago, it almost exploded, and Jim opened it up and cleaned it out and shellacked it, and we put it back on the shelf. Because, you see, I don't ever, ever want to forget where I came from. I never want to get so egotistical, so self-centered in my sobriety, or so comfortable in my sobriety, that I forget where I came from, and that I'm only one drink away from a drunk today. So that's a reminder every time I put my groceries up that that little can of onion soup sits there. I find sobriety at that time. Like I said, I should have. I was certainly at the bottom of Skid Row. Jim came home one day, and he had seen a sign down on Congress Street that said, "Do you have a problem with alcohol in your family? If so, call this number." And you know he did. It was Intergroup, and he called Intergroup, and they sent a man out to talk to me about my drinking. Now, drinking, you never talked about my drinking. You got to believe that only one person in this world could ever say I was a drunk or talk about my drinking, and that was my mother. And I drank like Aunt Cora, you know. So Jim
asked me if I would talk to this man, and because things were so bad between us and things were not good at all, I agreed to talk to this man. So he came in and he told me his story, and it was a terrible story. And I listened, and when he left, I told Jim, that guy sure has a problem, but I don't. Wasn't too many years after I sobered up, I was talking at a convention in Houston, afterwards, this man came up. He said, "Oh, I'm the guy that made that 12-step call on you." And he said, "No wonder it didn't take. I was drunk when I was talking to you." If you ain't got it, you can't give it away, right? Jim came in shortly after that, and he said he had gotten a job out at NASA doing some welding. And we were just thrilled to death because he had not worked in so many years, you know. Things had been just horrible for him. He could get a job and then he'd lose it because he was so worried about me all the time. And he said, "Now let's move out to League City, which is only a couple of miles from NASA, and let's start all over again and let's don't drink." Now, I don't know why he said that, because he never drank anyway, but he, you know, was, "Let's do this." And I agreed with him. I thought that was the most wonderful thing, wonderful idea he'd ever had. And we could start all over again. So we did. We moved out to League City, and it was just wonderful. I stayed sober for 3 months, and this is once more is where I think God stepped into my life, allowed me to stay sober for 3 months. This is somebody that had to drink every 2 hours. Why I was able to do it, I do not know. I can't remember anybody telling me I was going to die if I didn't quit drinking. But for some reason, I managed to not drink for 3 months. I got a real good job out at NASA as a secretary for General Electric. I was doing real good. I got a commendation for being good on my job, and Jim was doing good, and we were eating for a change, and we were paying the rent. You know, if you just put the cork in the jug, things get better. You don't have to do anything but that. Now, we all know that you got to do the steps in your life, work the steps in your life to find this peace of mind and happiness we're all looking for. But at that point in time, just simply not drinking was doing the job for me, because I didn't know anything about AA. So I came home on December the 15th, and I told Jim, I said, "They put me in charge of the Christmas party." "You're way ahead of me." "We're going to the Christmas party, and I'm going to have one drink, and I'm going to drink like a lady." Now, I don't know how ladies drink. I never knew any of them, you know. And I sure wasn't one, so I didn't know. But anyway, and he said, "Oh, please, let's don't go. You know, things are going so good for us. We don't really need that and all that." And I said, "Oh, you know, I always had my way." So we went to the Christmas party, and of course, I had one drink and many more. And I got real drunk that night, and being a good alcoholic, I tried to go to work the next morning, and I got in a ditch, and my boss pulled me out of the ditch and fired me, took me home and fired me, and that was the end of my job. I can remember going through Christmas, and just vaguely going through Christmas. Was in almost a total blackout for the next, well, it was May 30, 1966, when I called Alcoholics Anonymous in a blackout. And these AA women, they came up to take me to a meeting, and I peeped around the curtains and wouldn't let them in. And AA women are pretty persistent women, and they got me. And they took me to this little meeting down in Dickinson, Texas, which is not very far from League City. And I called it my little sick group, because I'm the only person that stayed sober from that group. And let me tell you why. I would go to the meeting drinking, and I'd take my bottle with me, and I would have intermission, and I would go out, and I would have a drink, and I'd come back, and if the speaker were up here, loudmouth like me, I would say, "I'm sick and tired of listening to you. Why don't you shut up and sit down?" And I would kick my shoes up in the ceiling, and I did all of these crazy things. Now, you know yourself, you would not permit that in your group. I know we would not. But they never said anything to me, you know. They never said, you know, "Why don't you leave and come back when you want sobriety," and all that kind of good stuff. Or take me out and talk to me on the side. Nobody ever said anything to me. And so I just kept on going. And I went to that meeting for almost 3 months, you know, drinking. And I must have learned something there. Because on September 30, 1966, I drove my little drunk car home. Now, that's the car with all the bucks on it, you know. And I had picked up two bottles of vodka, and I had consumed one of them, and I put the other one on the front seat of the car, and I had to be drunk to do that, because that would be the first place Jim would have looked. And I drove the car, and I parked it on the front porch. And Jim came out very angry. And he said, "You've been drinking." And nobody ever accused me of drinking without a fight, you know. Now, my husband is a perfect gentleman, was a perfect gentleman. He had never struck me before in his whole life. Lord knows he should have, but he never did. But we must have connected, because he hit me and I went down. And when I went down, I came back up fighting. And I broke my leg on the rail of the bed. And I proceeded to run with that broken leg to the end of the house to call the police to come and get him for striking me. And I broke my leg in two other places. And I went down. You know, I say that God had to take my legs away from me so I couldn't run anymore. I was like that little toy doll, you know, that some of you old-timers remember. I know the little celluloid doll that winds up in the back, has a spring, and its little legs are going 90 miles an hour, and it comes up against the wall, and it stops, and its little legs are still going 90 miles an hour. That was the story of my life. You know, I was always running and searching and looking for something, and when I got it, it wasn't good enough, and I'd head out in another direction, and when I got that, it wasn't good enough, and then I'd go in another direction, and that was the way I lived my life. It was like I was always looking for something, and I know today that I found it when I found Alcoholics Anonymous in my higher power. I know that today, but I didn't know what I was looking for all those years, but that was the way I lived. And so I went down, and I mean, I was on the floor. And Jim came to me, and for the first time I can ever remember, offered me a drink because he knew I was in so much pain. And I looked up at him, and I said, "Jim, you've seen me take the last drink you'll ever see me take." And they took me to the hospital, and I lay in that little ante room at the hospital, and they had the curtains drawn, and the doctor and my husband were talking outside this curtain, and I could hear them talking. And the doctor said, "Mr. Marsh, we can't operate on your wife. She's too drunk. We've called a specialist in from Houston. I don't know what we're going to do, whether she's going to lose this leg or whether we're going to be able to repair it, but whichever one it is, she'll never walk again." Because I had not just broken my leg, I had destroyed my leg. And I was as sober as I am right now, and even though I was so very, very drunk, and I heard this. And for the first time since I was a little girl, I said a prayer, and I said, "God, if you'll give me back my leg and let me walk again, I'll walk the rest of my life the way you'll have me go." And do you know that God gave me back my leg? I have a metal plate from my knee to my ankle, and I don't even limp today. I lay in that hospital room. I was there for about 2 months, recovering not only from the drug alcohol, but from the other drugs that they gave me. They knew absolutely nothing about the treatment of alcoholism. And they filled me with Librium and everything else they could. And I was laying in my bed one night, and they had me in traction, and they had the sides of my beds pulled up, and there was no way I could have gotten out of that bed. And they came in, and they found me in the middle of the room. And you see, in the back of the room, I saw a bar, and on that bar were six bottles of booze. And on the other side of the room, there was a door, and a man was standing in the door. And I don't know what any of this represents. I like to think that the bar was my old life, and the door was a new life for me. And I don't know who the man was standing in the door. I know that I was probably hallucinating from the withdrawal of the drugs, or that I had a tremendous spiritual experience at that time, because I know from that day to this day, I've never wanted nor desired a drink of alcohol. And for an old girl that couldn't go more than 2 hours, that indeed is a miracle. I lay in that hospital, and nobody came to visit me. My husband hated me. He didn't visit me. My family back in Birmingham wished to heck I'd died. And even these AA people didn't come to visit me. And I knew what the loneliness of the alcoholic was. And I was determined that I was coming out of there. I was going back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was going to stay sober. And I didn't know how I was going to do it. I just knew that I was going to do it. And I got out of the hospital. I was in a cast from my waist to my toes. I was in a wheelchair. And these little people from Dickinson, this little sick group, came up and picked me up and took me to meetings. And I can tell you one thing. I was not the arrogant, self-centered character that I was anymore. I was in the back of the room. I would hold my head with my hands. I could not read the big book. And you were my big book for a long, long time. I listened to you and I wanted sobriety. I didn't know how to get it. I just stayed there until I began to hear what you had to tell me. On May 30, 1966, the first day that I contacted Alcoholics Anonymous, Becky, my little daughter, was born. Not to me. We adopted Becky when she was 5 years old. I managed to stay sober at least by the simple means of seeing your faces and looking at your faces and knowing that you had sobriety and that I wanted it. I was sitting in my wheelchair one night, and I knew I was going to get drunk at my husband. You see, he was not doing the things that he should be doing. You know, he was not being kind to me, for one thing. You know, isn't it absolutely amazing that we alcoholics, particularly women, sober up, and we expect our husbands, or vice versa, to be Mr. or Mrs. Wonderful, when we have run over these people for 20 years, you know, with our alcoholism. And that's what I expected of Jim. I expected him to be Mr. Wonderful. And he had just started going to Al-Anon, and he really didn't know too much about all this stuff, you know. So I was going to get drunk at him. And when he hit the front door that night, and I can remember that it was raining, and I was feeling sorry for myself. I was in my wheelchair, and I was sitting there waiting for him to hit the door because I was going to get drunk at him. And I had kept a six-pack in my closet right beside me there to prove to myself I didn't have to drink it. Now, I don't recommend that to anybody, but that's what I did, you know. And when he got in, you know, I was going to get drunk at him. So he hit the front door, and I said, "I'm going to get drunk." And he said, "I don't give a damn if you do." Now, he had heard that from Al-Anon, because nobody, he would never have said that. And when he said that, you know, all the old feelings and everything just hit me all of a sudden, you know, that temper and all that stuff just welled up in me. And I reached over and grabbed the closet door to get that beer, you know, and almost pulled the door down and grabbed that six-pack and brought it and threw it back here on the table. And in just a second, you know, sanity returned, and I looked at him and I said, "Ain't no son of a bitch in this world worth getting drunk over." Like that today. Do we, Maggie? And I believe that. I don't believe anyone's worth getting drunk over. I don't care what you do or say to me, or what my group does or says to me, or what anybody does. My sobriety comes first. And I'm not going to let personalities get involved in my program. So I went back to AA this time, and with a new vigor, I was going for me, not for him or anybody else, and I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. I met my sponsor. She told me there were certain things that I had to do to keep me from going back and drinking again, and one of the things she told me was I had to clean up my life. I had to make amends. My mother died 2 years before I sobered up, and I was poured on. My brother sent me an airplane ticket to go from Houston to Birmingham. I was poured onto the plane in Birmingham, and I was poured off, you know, poured on in Houston and poured off in Birmingham, you know. And I was drunk at the funeral home and embarrassed my family that night. I was drunk at the funeral, and as they lowered my mother's body into the ground, I just passed out drunk. So I was in a terrible shape at that time. I would not let my brother come to the funeral. That's my oldest brother, because he hadn't spoken to my mother for about 12 years before she died and nearly broke her heart. I called him up the day of the funeral, and I said, "If you show up at the funeral, I'll blow your brains out." And he knew I was capable of doing it, and so he didn't get to come to my mother's funeral. Never occurred to me how I had broken my mother's heart, but I was judging him. So when I sobered up, I had to make amends to this guy. My oldest brother is 6'2". He's 19 years older than I am. Of course, he wasn't at that time, but he's 6'2". He was working at that time, and I knew that I had to make amends, and I drove all the way nonstop from Houston, Texas to Birmingham. I'd asked my sponsor if I could do it by letter, and she said no. So I had to make amends in person, and I was scared. I don't mind telling you, I was scared.
And I went to the plant that he worked, and I asked the guard. I said, call, you know, my brother up from the plant, but don't tell him I'm here because he won't come if he knows it's me. And when Ed hit the top of the stairs there, and I was standing across, shaking like everything, across the hall there, a big smile came on his face, and I ran across the room, and I threw my arms around him, and I said, Ed, will you forgive me for the things I've done that have hurt you? And he said, oh, but I've hurt you too. And in just a moment, all the hate in the world drained out of me. I hated that guy. I drank over him more times than you can imagine because I hated him so much. Today, we're real good friends. I just got through visiting with him. He's very ill right now and way up in years, and we're friends now, and I can go back and I can visit with him in peace. And it's a wonderful thing that Alcoholics Anonymous allows us to go full circle and make amends to those that we have harmed. I couldn't make amends to this husband of mine because, you see, there would be no way I could have made amends to him because I had totally destroyed this man. I had taken everything away from him that a person could take from anyone. And I knew the only way in the world that I could ever make amends to him would be just simply to stay sober, to get my life straightened out, and be the kind of wife that he would have me be. And I can tell you today that my life began at 40 when I sobered up. It truly, truly began at 40. And that we had the most beautiful marriage after that time that anybody could have. He always allowed me to be me, and I always allowed him to be him. And we just had a marvelous time. My Jim was taken from me, it'll be 3 years, January the 18th. On our 44th wedding anniversary, he had a massive heart attack and died. I was in Dallas, Texas at the time at a delegates conference, and always doing what he wanted me to do. I didn't want to go. I can remember very well that morning I didn't want to go. And he always insisted that I do anything in connection with Alcoholics Anonymous because he loved this program so well. He was an Alateen sponsor for 19 years before he died and absolutely loved Alateen and certainly was a member of Al-Anon. But I miss him, and I'm doing the things today that he always wanted me to do, and that's to continue with Alcoholics Anonymous and be the kind of member that he knew that I always wanted to be. And I know today he knows exactly where I am. You know, I had a lot of people to make amends to, but my sponsor told me to make amends to the people that cared about me, and those were the ones I tried to make amends to. 2 years after we sobered up, Jim and I decided that we wanted to adopt a child. I was 42 years old at the time, and I didn't want a baby. We was going to bring an older child into our life, someone that we could really give the kind of love and care to that we felt like both of us had never gotten as kids. And so we put our application into the state of Texas to adopt a child, and we'd waited 18 months, and we hadn't heard anything from him. And I said, Jim, I guess God has said no. You know, no used not be in my vocabulary. If I wanted something, I got it. I didn't care who I ran over or what I had to do to get it. I'd get it. But I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that God says a lot of time, no, wait, there's something better on down the road. And so I just told him, I says, well, I guess God has said no. And he agreed with me, so we sort of put it aside. It wasn't many nights later that the phone rang. This lady said, Ms. Marsh, we have a little girl for you, and her name is Becky. And she's 4 years old. And she was born May 30, 1966, the day that I first called Alcoholics Anonymous. And Becky came into our life, and we're both 27 years old today, and we both act like it. Becky became the joy of our life. I can't tell you how much we love that girl. Jim used to put her on his knee at night, you know, and Joshua up and down and play with her and tell her how much he loved her. And there wasn't many nights, you know, that we didn't both say our prayers together at night. And when she'd go off to work go off to school in the morning, I'd just hang out the door and I'd say, Becky, I love you, as she was going down the street, you know, embarrass her to death. But, you know, I always wanted Becky to know that we loved her because I never heard those words from my parents. And I sure don't blame my parents for my alcoholism, but I never heard those words from my parents. I love you. You know, if you've got kids, go home tonight and put your arms around them and and just cuddle them up close and tell them that you love them. You may have said those words 1,000 times, and they may never have heard you. And I always wanted Becky to know those words, I love you. When Becky was 18 years old, she walked in the house one day, and she told Jim and I that she didn't love us anymore, that we'd never done anything for her, and that she was leaving. And she walked out of our lives, and I'm telling you that this old gal couldn't take it. My husband, being the good Al-Anon he was able to handle it, but I couldn't handle it. And I had been invited to speak in New York at a conference up there, and I told Jim I wasn't going because I've always believed that if you don't walk like you talk, you ain't got no business behind this podium telling somebody else how to live, you know. And I had spouted my mouth out to my girls and told them, you know, or tried to tell them, you know, some things about their kids, you know, when I couldn't do it for myself. And I said, no, I'm not going. And he says, I've never known you yet to renege on a commitment. August says, I'll go with you. So he went to New York. I agreed, and we went on to New York, and he went with me. And it was in the beautiful Catskill Mountains in New York, and it was just the most beautiful place you've ever seen in your life. And it was in November, just about this time of the year. And I sat in that hotel room, and I prayed and asked God to give me the strength to go on because I had lost this precious daughter of mine, and to tell me how I could handle living like this and to get my program back into shape. And I was a Sunday morning speaker that time, and when I got through, I was walking down the hallway going back to my hotel room, and this young man yelled and said, Olga, can I talk with you for a moment? And I said, surely. And I stopped, and the man said, I know why you came here today. He said, I tried to commit suicide. I had a magnum pistol in my mouth, and I was going to blow my head off. And my wife stopped me, and I was on my way to a treatment center. I had been sober 5 years, and I got on Valium, and I lost my sobriety, and I was going to end it all. And said, I asked her to please let me come on up here this morning to hear the speaker. And he said, you told me what I needed to hear to go on. And I knew right then and there that we don't talk to a whole multitude of people when we stand at this podium. We talk to one person. And I hope this morning I'm talking to one person to know that if this old gal can make it, you can make it. That there is a beautiful, beautiful life ahead of you. And that made me have the strength and the courage to come back home and to get on with my program. And, of course, Becky came back. She married this young dope. Erase that. Anyway, she married this young man. And after three little precious boys walked off and left her and to raise these little boys by herself. He was a drug addict. He's still a drug addict. And Becky is absolutely the most beautiful young lady you've ever seen in your life, and I love her dearly. You know, I have been so fortunate in Alcoholics Anonymous to have done everything I've ever wanted to do. God has allowed me to do everything. I've owned a business for many years. I started the business off with $4,000 of borrowed money and no credit. And I was told by the local banker that I was crazy, that a woman of 53 couldn't do that. And I said, don't tell me I can't do something. And I talked another banker into lending me this money. And with God's help, I started a little office supply business, which I sold in 1985. And it was a tremendous business, and it still is a tremendous business. And it's strictly, you know, because of God's grace and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that I was allowed to do these things. I've been in service work ever since I sobered up, and I absolutely love service work, and I encourage any of you who are not in service to find it because it allows your program to expand to a point that is unbelievable. I know people all over this country. I was a delegate from our Southeast Texas area in 1975, and I have been serving and just went rotated off of the board of directors in New York as a committeeman on the Correctional Facilities Committee. I served there 4 years and absolutely love it because corrections is my work, is my love, and I love prison work. God has allowed me to do everything I have ever wanted to do. I've just been everything that I You know, I was greedy. You know, I don't know about y'all. I want the whole pie. I don't want just a little piece here, you know. I want everything that AA has to offer, and I'm willing to work for it. Just like I was willing to work at the age of 16 to get what I wanted out of life. Today, I want everything that will allow me to find a way to live and be happy and peaceful in this life today. I've been privileged to work with many, many women alcoholics. I have so many gals, and the proof of all of this came to pass when I came in from Dallas after my husband had died and had this heart attack, and I walked in the front door and all those girls were there to greet me. And where else could we get that? There's no place we could find that. I don't believe in church or any place else where the bond and the friendship is there that we find in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I have just been so fortunate in doing everything that I've wanted to do. You know, I've said many times, you know, to some of my girls, heck, you know, if I'd have sobered up at 25, I might have been president of the United States. Me and Hillary. So you young people, you know, you might be president of the United States one of these days. Because I believe that God allows us to do everything we're capable of doing. I believe that if we keep our enthusiasm, I believe that if we can keep our outlook on life as it is in Alcoholics Anonymous, we can do anything that we want to do. And I truly, truly believe that. My husband, before he died, had gone from being a welder to being a project manager for NASA for construction, making more money than he ever dreamed, a heck of a lot more than I made. So you don't have to just be an alcoholic. You can be an Al-Anon and do it too, girls. I believe that God has been real good to me. I believe he gave me a man that loved me unconditionally when I was so unlovable. I believe he gave me people like you that loved me when I was unlovable. I believe he's allowed me to do everything I wanted to do in life. After Jim died, I got depressed for about 6 months. And I thought, well, maybe my life is over too. And I guess sanity returned one day. And I said, no, that's not what Jim would want me to do. And I went back to college. And I got my state license to be a counselor, substance abuse counselor. Something I'd said I never, ever would do. Because I had worked so closely with Alcoholics Anonymous, and yet I know this is a job, and that's Alcoholics Anonymous. So I got my state license. I was employed by, as you know, we have a governor in Texas that's a recovering alcoholic who has formed all of these private prisons, substance abuse prisons, for guys in prison and gals in prison who have problems with alcohol and drugs. They are separate from the regular prison. They're right by it, but they're separate. And I was employed by them as a counselor. And a month ago, I was made clinical supervisor, this old gal. So you can do it too. So God has been so good to me. I'm doing what I've always wanted to do in my life is work in the prison system. I'm doing the thing that I want to do most, and that's working with alcoholics that need help, that maybe will get back on the streets and not harm you and I. So I've been the most fortunate person in the world. And I could not have been so fortunate if it hadn't been for you, because you gave me everything that I have today, and you made me what I am today. And I want to thank all of y'all for allowing me to come over here and sharing with you. I know I probably talked too long, but I just couldn't help it. You're such a beautiful crowd, and I love you all, and God bless you.